This is an interview with Bill Dentzer for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is July 20th, 2011. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
We're talking today at Bill's home in Larchmont, New York. First of all, Bill, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in 1929 in Rochester, Pennsylvania, a kind of a bedroom community for steel mill workers in the Pittsburgh area.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was the newspaper advertising, was the head of advertising for a local newspaper. My mother was the housewife.
Did you have any siblings?
Had one sister.
Okay.
A younger sister.
All right. And where did you go to college?
Muskingum College in New Concord, Ohio.
All right. What did you study there?
I majored in politics and minored in economics and speech.
Now, you were involved in student politics at this time, right?
Yes, I was. I was, by virtue of the fact I was president of the junior sophomore class and the junior class and the student body. In my senior year, I was involved in the, came to be involved in the National Student Association, and I subsequently became president of that in the year after I was graduated from Muskingum.
And what did you do with the association? What was that involved in that?
Traveling around the country and trying to keep some kind of contact on a minuscule budget with the number of college and university student governments who were members of the association. Our basic effort was to try to make student governments more relevant, something more than choosers of May Queens and May Queen ceremonies and things like that, and to help break down racial segregation on American campuses. And international activity as well, trying to reach out, particularly to the less developed countries.
Sounds like it kept you pretty busy.
I visited, I think, more than 30 states, sometimes speaking three times at three different universities and colleges in major metropolitan areas.
Did you have much time to study?
Well, I was graduated.
Oh, you graduated.
I was graduated, and I had the salary of $2,000 a year. On which I paid most of my expenses. Mm-hmm. So we were really on a shoestring at the time.
And
the association had ran a travel program, which unfortunately was a money loser, and we were deeply in debt, and it was a tough year.
And you ended up getting some funding from an interesting source.
Yes, although I didn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We were raising money for an international program, and we received money from a foundation for youth and student affairs, which was then being formed, and from others for our program. After I left office, I discovered that the money was funded by CIA through these cutouts. Then this all came back when the thing blew in 1967. And it was revealed in a magazine article that the agency was supporting the National Student Association's international activities and other organizations as well. I was then the aid mission director in Peru, and I got a call from a friend who used to work for me, who was then Hubert Humphrey's international guy, saying that James Reston had said in the Sunday's paper that I had come to CIA for money during my presidency. Because the agency wanted it didn't want to look as if it was, you know, raiding college kids' idealism, and then for that reason. But since James Reston also had said that, and since Time magazine labeled me as the guy who started it all, how do you say I didn't? But I subsequently was involved in it, and I'm happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it all over again.
It must have been quite a surprise to see that in print.
It was. Mm-hmm. We always knew that it could blow at some point. It was always the risk. But
okay.
We got money for what we wanted to do. And as I said, those of us who were involved in it did what we thought was right. The only thing that was tough for all of us was to have to lie, effectively to lie about it.
Mm-hmm. So after your year as the president of the National Student Association, you then spent a year in Europe working with student groups there.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. In the international organization that we tried to form and did form.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't form it to be anti-communist. We formed it to be non-communist. Our platform really was that we didn't care whether it was Spain or South Africa or Czechoslovakia. suppressing student voices. We were uniformly anti-totalitarian, fascist as well as communist.
Mm-hmm. And
and practical. We were trying to make contacts with what we called at the time the less developed countries.
Right. So after that year in Europe, you actually ended up having a career in national security. You joined the army.
And was assigned to CIA and worked there.
Okay.
Until Kennedy was elected. And one of his special assistants was a former officer of NSA before I was president of the NSA. So I wanted to leave the agency, and so I worked on the formulation of the Foreign Aid Task Force, which gave birth to the Agency for International Development.
Can I ask real quickly who the special aide was?
Ralph Dungan.
Okay, yeah. And then you worked on this task force that looked at the U.S. foreign aid programs.
Right. My job essentially was to try to vet possible candidates for the top 20 spots in the new agency.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there were two foreign aid agencies. One, the Development Loan Fund, which had been created to make loans alongside the previously existing International Cooperation Administration, mm-hmm. which gave technical assistance. And the idea was to bring both of these kinds of aid organizations together in one organization and to focus on countries with both the lending and the technical assistance weapons at hand.
What was the problem with the existing aid organizations at the time?
Well, you couldn't focus. There were two different agencies doing something more or less in the same country without the country focus that you can get if you have one agency with both these technical assistance and lending capabilities. And the lending capabilities are very modest. We wanted to have in the task force low-cost loans, highly subsidized loans, to a much greater scale than was possible in the Development Loan Fund. There was a lot of concern that we focus on individual countries with all of the technical tools available on a country focus.
Okay. Did you work at all on the writing of the 1961 Foreign Assistance Act? This was the act that led to the creation of USAID.
Of AID.
Mm-hmm.
I think that only tangentially. A lot of that was done, because my job was more of a talent search guy than participating in the drafting of the legislation.
Right. And then you also worked with General Lucius Clay on a commission as well.
Yes. President Kennedy wanted to get the foreign aid program off to a big start, a good start. And appointed General Clay and a distinguished group of people, including the ex-president of the World Bank, Eugene Black, and a former Secretary of the State, Robert Levitt, to this committee. And I was the executive secretary of that group. And it was through my relationship with Eugene Black that, in fact, brought me to the United States, brought me to New York in 1969.
Okay. Tell me briefly about what else you did during the 1960s. You also worked in Peru, right?
Yes. I was special assistant to the first two heads of AID, special assistant to Teodoro Moscoso, who was the head of the U.S. head of the Alliance for Progress, worked in the State Department, and then became aid mission director in Peru, 1965 to 68. Came back in 1968. On my own initiative, because I knew, I quote unquote, that Nixon would beat Humphrey, and as a Democrat, I knew I would be put out to pasture. So yep. I came back to the United States to be sure that the pasture was a U.S. pasture rather than a Peruvian pasture.
That was just your reading of the
political... Of the politics.
Okay.
And then I was when I came back, Saul Linowitz, who was the U.S. representative to the Organization of American States, needed a deputy, whose deputy had departed, and Saul appointed me to be the deputy assistant, his deputy, with the personal rank of ambassador. Saul wanted to be Secretary of State in the Humphrey administration, and I had he knew that I had very good ties to the Humphrey people, and it wouldn't hurt his ambitions if he appointed me as his deputy for economic matters. That mm-hmm. was my side of the things. I dealt with the coordination of the IMF, AID, World Bank, and the Inter-American Development Bank in their aid programs to Latin America.
Okay. But once the election happened, you knew that the writing was on the wall and that it would be time to leave soon?
Right. And so I began to explore, what can I do in line with my interests? Twice when I was back as aid mission director in Peru, on one occasion, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bobby Kennedy. And, mm-hmm. So my interest shifted at that point from international affairs to America's urban problems, America's development problems, particularly its urban problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked for different places where I could work in those areas. And Eugene Black had been tapped to be head of an economic council in New York,
mm-hmm.
which really shouldn't have existed, I think. But he nonetheless was tapped to do all of that. He agreed to do it. Nelson appointed him, and Black wanted someone who he could rely on to be the staff director, and I did that. So I just happily came to New York.
So during this period of the 1960s, when you were working on development in Peru and in other areas, did you work on banking or finance at all?
Not really, mm-hmm. no. That obviously was an important part of any development program, but only in the sense that we dealt with the country's macroeconomic policies from the point of view of whether they were deserving of loan assistance. Were they doing the right thing with their economic policies enough to justify what we call program loans,
mm-hmm.
which were generalized loans, which essentially were balance of payments loans geared to performance of certain things, like a budget deficit with certain limitations, mm-hmm. raising tax revenue and so forth. But we didn't specialize on that. It was just one of the many things that we looked at in looking at the ability of a country to utilize our resources, both our lending resources and our technical assistance resources.
Okay. So as you were telling me, after you left government service, you went to the New York State Council of Economic Advisors. But up until that point, you had mostly worked on development in developing countries, not
yes.
development in
yes.
the United States.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
So what were you doing at the council?
Well, I began at the council in April of 1969, commuting from Washington, trying to put together a staff. It quickly became apparent that the budget division of the New York state government was not interested in having us meddle in their affairs as they saw it. We could do income projections, for example,
mm-hmm.
but income projections at the state level are both economic and political, and so we were kept away from those kinds of things. So once they put together a staff, we did publish one report before I left to become superintendent of banks in March of 70. Frank Willey, who was the superintendent of banks at the time for the state of New York, was named to be head of the FDIC. Someone needed to take his place. The governor's deputy secretary, Harry Albright, wanted to be the superintendent of banks. But Governor Rockefeller, especially as he was looking forward to another run as governor, didn't want to let Harry go. I had gotten to know Harry because he was the appointment secretary. So in my coming to New York and getting established and establishing the council and clearing arrangements for our office through him, we'd gotten to know each other well. And Harry came to me at one point and said, Would you like to be superintendent of banks for a while? It's a job that I would like to get at some point, but the government won't let me go.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, yeah, yeah. And so in March of 70, I became superintendent of banks.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask you, did you know Governor Rockefeller?
Not at all until I met him after we came, after I became staff director, executive director of the State Council of Economic Advisors.
I thought it was interesting that you left the federal government service because Nixon came into office, and then you went and worked for the Economic Council advising his opponent.
Really ironic.
Right. Uh-huh. And then at the time, Rockefeller was also working on a commission that was looking at the Alliance for Progress as well, which was an area of expertise for you.
Yes, and I did not want to be involved in that because I knew that he would rain on the parade of the Alliance for Progress.
Mm-hmm. He's quite critical of it in the report.
Huh?
I think he was quite critical of it.
He was very critical.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that there were things that were critical of.
But you thought the report went too far?
But so I wanted to. Mm-hmm. Someone said to me, maybe you should be on his team. No. I don't want to do that.
Right.
I knew that I would say things in meeting. I can recall one meeting he had with the council. And he was saying, we have to do something about housing in New York City. You know, we got to do something. And I said, yeah, abolish rent control. I know it's impossible, politically impossible to do that, but if you want to see more private sector housing, abolish rent control. Now, I know it can't be done, but anything short of that is not going to get anywhere.
After you took over the position of superintendent of banks of New York State, what were your priorities there? Well, first of all, let's start with the position. What were the responsibilities of the position?
The superintendent of bank is the chief New York State bank regulator. Mm-hmm. And that involves commercial banks. All the big banks at that time were state chartered except Citibank and Chase Manhattan Bank. Savings banks, savings and loan associations, money lenders of different sorts. So that at that point in time, not true now, most of the commercial banks, which were the important banks, were state chartered banks, mm-hmm. Manufacturers, Hanover Chemical Bank, Bankers Trust, Irving Trust, etc. I think of the things that were most important in my own view of my tenure as superintendent for those 2 years. One was making it possible for co-op apartments to be financed by banks. There were legal problems in making that possible. And clearly opening the market for co-op loans to banks and thrifts was very important. And we got legislation through. Being a Democrat, I could work more easily with the Democrats. Being a Nelson Rockefeller guy, a banking superintendent, I could work with the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so by working with the committees, we got those changed. There also was a usury ceiling. No bank could make a mortgage that exceeded 7.5%, which is fine if banks were willing to make mortgages at 7.5%.
That was a state law.
That was a state law. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, liberals like laws like that because they think it keeps the lending rate down. Well, it does, except that when inflation looks like it's going to be 8 or 9%, banks don't make those loans. So removing the ceiling was something I worked with the Democrats to do when we did that. The biggest thing was changing banking law so that we could eventually have a single banking district in New mm-hmm. York. As in most states at the time, banks were protected markets. A bank might be able to branch within its district. It couldn't branch outside of its banking district. That was the recipe for lack of competition. And breaking down those barriers to competition was important to me. I finally succeeded in getting legislation through that said within 5 years we would go to a statewide bank.
This is the bank redistricting bill of 1971.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Did that encounter a lot of opposition in the legislature or from the banks?
the fact that I build a 5-year time period into it helped a great deal, because it gave people some time to work out relationships about who might buy whom. Getting the legislation through was difficult because many Republican, particularly Republican upstate and non-metropolitan New York legislators were closely attached to local banks. At one point, Chase Manhattan Bank wanted to buy a bank in Long Island, which was in the district of the Speaker of the Assembly.
In Garden City?
Garden yeah. City. And it was a reasonable acquisition that I could have approved. But I went to Perry Duryea, who was the Speaker of the Assembly, and told him that I would turn it down if he would be sympathetic to a statewide redistricting for 2 years. David Rockefeller was not very happy.
This was Nelson Rockefeller's younger brother, right?
Yes, and I'm sure he talked to Nelson Rockefeller about it. In fact, I have evidence that he talked to Nelson Rockefeller. But I explained that my long-term goal in doing all this was to do what the governor wanted to do, and to break down this anti-competitive banking district, the law that we had to function under, and go to statewide banking.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another thing that you did was to introduce legislation that would allow bank holding companies in other states to expand into New York, as long as the other states granted reciprocal privileges to New York State.
Exactly. The mm-hmm. idea, again, was to spur competition among banks for consumer dollars, consumer loans, mm-hmm. consumer deposits, and other things.
Were you able to get that legislation passed?
We passed it. I think we passed it in New York. I'm sure we passed it in New York. And some other states followed. Mm-hmm. I've lost track of that one some years ago.
Okay. Yeah. There was one other interesting note I saw in the press from this time, that you had filed a brief in a case before the Supreme Court about a Colorado antitrust suit. Can you tell me what that was about?
Again, it was a case that came up before the Supreme Court involving competition, pro-competition. And we were always pro-competition. So I filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court, effectively criticizing the position of the National Bank of Colorado? One of the Colorado banks. Mm-hmm.
We can look that up. So.
Suffice to say that we filed the amicus brief. The Attorney General of New York, Lefkowitz, was very unhappy with that because he heard from the Attorney General of Colorado that we'd filed this brief and insisted that I should have cleared it with him.
You weren't under any legal obligation to do so, were
no.
you?
But so I just heard him out and fait accompli.
Mm-hmm. All right. So another of your responsibilities during this period was approving or disapproving mergers. There were quite a number of mergers coming through before you during this period.
Yes.
One of them was Bankers Trust. Do you recall that case?
I do. Mm-hmm. Bankers Trust and Irving Trust. I turned down two acquisitions on the basis of the terminology is potential competition. When you look at any merger or any holding company acquisition in another area, you look at the geographic market and the product market and the degree of concentration in those markets on the part of major players. There's the school of thought that says you should look beyond that to foster potential competition, not look only at actual competition, but look at potential competition. And my pro-competitive streak made me look very seriously at the doctrine of potential competition. And I turned down those two mergers because I felt that I wanted smaller holding companies to be able to grow in areas where they were not strong at the present time, but could be strong. I wanted to see more bank holding companies in New York than the major holding companies, which grew out of New York City-based banks. So I turned down those those two mergers, I must say, it was a close case. I can see why people disagreed with me, and some of them did vehemently.
And one person that disagreed with you was your successor, who later reversed that decision.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
So. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about leaving office. Did the governor ask you to leave?
Let's put it this way. I was in no doubt that if I left, that would be a salutary development.
Okay.
He had gotten a lot of static about me from banks where I turned down their mergers or acquisitions. So that some banks thought I was doing a great job. Those that were on the wrong end, as they saw it, of my decisions, didn't think I was doing a good job at all.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't have much trouble finding a new position with the New York Stock Exchange.
The question was not that's true. But I wanted something that would be useful and interesting. One of the possibilities I had at the time was being president of a large savings bank in New York. There were a couple of them that talked to me about that. But that didn't interest me. That didn't challenge me at all. And in the course of being superintendent, this is directly bears on our subject today, the Banking and Securities Industry Committee came to see me in the person of John Meyer, the ex-chairman of the board of Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, and Herman Beavis, who was the executive director, I guess he was, of the Banking and Securities Industry Committee. They had wanted, as a culmination of their work, to have a trust company formed in New York, which could hold securities for other trusts similar to be formed trust companies. They couldn't get, they said, a charter from the Federal Reserve because the Federal Reserve didn't want to charter a bank, or especially a limited-purpose trust company, nor did the controller of the currency want to charter a special or limited-purpose trust company. So they said that their only hope would be to have, if I would charter this to-be-formed organization as a trust company, which their lawyers told them was necessary in order for it to deal nationally with other trust companies, other depositories in other states that also wanted to be formed. My view was that the public purpose was valid, but that the capabilities of the state banking department were not enough to supervise such an entity. And I would only do it if the SEC wanted me to. And because the idea was this depository would be spun out of the New York Stock Exchange, it would cease to be regulated by this SEC, because the SEC could regulate the depository within the Clearing Corporation of the New York Stock Exchange, because it was an entity of the New York Stock Exchange.
So the SEC was regulating the was regulating CCS at that time.
I didn't realize it would take so long to set up the trust company. So that we never were in a situation where the SEC would cease to regulate the depository.
But the SEC was positive about that. They had
they wanted me to do it. I talked to the chairman of the SEC, who encouraged me to do this, and said that they would. And I made it clear that I wanted them to do the substantive regulation, because we had the banking department had no ability to do all that.
And this was in 1972.
Yes.
Now, prior to this point, there had been some talk of a federal solution to this problem. In other words, creating some federal organization that would handle securities deposits.
Congressman John Moss was in favor of that.
Uh-huh.
His view as a Californian, and as a liberal Democrat, was you can't trust New York at all. And, there's a lot to that point of view. Since the private sector couldn't get his act together, a federal solution was desired. That gave impetus to the New York, the Banking and Securities Industry Committee, who consisted of heads of the New York Clearinghouse, which is the major New York banks, New York Stock Exchange, the NASD, and the Amex. it gave impetus to have a private sector solution. They always were concerned the federal government, if it did something, would muck it up and do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They also wanted to be in control to the extent that they could, or at least be influential.
But was this federal solution still on the table at this point in 1972, or
yes,
was it gone?
Yes, it was on the table. It was on the table. It's hard to tell how much Moss... I met with Congressman Moss when he came to Peru, in mm-hmm. fact, when I was aid mission director. It's hard to tell how much of this was a threat to get people moving or how real it was as mm-hmm. as a proposal. But in any case, the Banking and Securities Industry Committee, BASIC, took it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so their view was we have to have a private sector solution, and we will do it.
Okay. Now, had you been following closely the problems on Wall Street, the paperwork crisis and all that?
No, just as a casual reader of the newspaper.
Okay. Was there anything comparable in the banking sector at all, just in terms of, you know, more paperwork or, you know, clearing
yes.
transactions?
Yes, because, as you know, in order to become a legal owner of a stock, you had to buy the stock. The seller of the stock had to have it transferred into your name, registered in your name, by a transfer agent. That's the only way title could change to stock. So when trading volume got to be 6 million shares a day, brokers were overwhelmed and transfer agents were overwhelmed. The brokers blamed the transfer agents, the transfer agents blamed the brokers, and both were right. Both fell down on the job. They were overwhelmed by the flow of paper,
mm-hmm.
which drove the idea of being able to change ownership by book entry on computers with computer records verifying the change of ownership. That was the whole theory of forming DTC
mm-hmm.
and other depositories that were formed subsequently around the country.
Okay. So here we are in 1972. You've authorized the creation of this limited trust company.
I didn't authorize
oh.
it. I left
mm-hmm.
before
oh.
I left before it was created. I left in March of 72,
mm-hmm.
came to but with CCS, Central Certificate Service, a portion of the Stock Clearing Corporation of the New York Stock Exchange in June
mm-hmm.
of that year. And it was my job, ironically, to satisfy the banking department that this limited purpose trust company should be formed.
Of course, you might have still known a couple of people there.
Yes, but they put us through the paces they
mm-hmm.
should put us through.
Right. Was there an interview process for this job, or did they just offer it to you?
I was told that they had talked to a number of other people, and for one reason or another, they finally descended to me.
Mm-hmm.
It would be an iffy proposition. Here was an idea that seemed like it would be a good idea, but would it be? Could it fail? Certainly could fail.
Mm-hmm.
You had to pick up a lot of your workforce on the New York Stock Exchange and then build a new organization, recruit a general counsel, the head of the data processing, you had to create an auditing function, a
mm-hmm.
personnel function. So I can see why people would, especially if they had good, useful jobs, might decide they didn't want to maybe the head of Exxon or General Motors wouldn't want this job.
Right. So did you have a master list of things to do when you started out in order to get the company set up?
Yes. You had to, we first, to show our serious intent, we spun CCS out of the Stock Clearing Corporation and made it CCS Inc. Had to put together an organization, staff it, had to begin the process of changing state laws around the country, which BASIC was deeply involved in and had set up a good relationship with the Uniform Commercial
Code
for state laws,
mm-hmm. Universal Commercial Code. Yeah.
Under the UCC, changes in the UCC.
Yeah.
So we had strong backing in theory and in practice
mm-hmm.
From the amendments to the UCC to do all this. Just a matter of getting through state legislatures around the country.
Mm-hmm. You also had to change the New York law that dealt with stock transfer taxes. or was that already underway?
No.
Okay.
No. There was a proposal in and around this area a little later for mm-hmm. stock transfer tax on, but that got shot down. We didn't play any role in that, but that got shot down as being counterproductive to the the whole idea of fostering stock ownership of securities.
So tell me about the relationship with the SEC during this period. You said that they were supportive at the beginning. Did you have to work closely with them?
Yes, indeed. The head of market regulation at the time, we've always dealt closely with the market. Market reg was, as you know perhaps, is the entity within the SEC that's concerned with organizations such as DTC. With every head of market regulation and his staff, we worked closely every step along the way. They have to approve all of our rules, all of our policies.
Who was the head there at the beginning?
Lee Picard was the head mm-hmm. of the market reg when Bill Casey was mm-hmm. was the chair.
That's right.
Who came after Lee? Was it Rick Ketchum? Rick came later.
Mm. Well, and anyhow, we can look that up later. That's fine. So, and then in May 1973, the company changed its name to the Depository Trust Company. Who picked out the name?
I did.
You did.
I did.
Was there anything else under consideration, or was it?
Not in my own mind. It had mm-hmm. to be Trust Company because we were a trust company, and we wanted to indicate we were a trust company. That there's a patina of respectability and solidity. With that, it's also true. We were a trust company. And we were a depository, so Depository Trust Company just made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And then you applied for a status under the Federal Reserve.
Yes, that was always the case. We always wanted to be regulated by the SEC and the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. The bankers in particular wanted to be regulated by the Federal Reserve because they did not have a uniformly high opinion mm-hmm. of the SEC. And they thought at least some ability to influence the Federal Reserve, and they felt comfortable in putting their own securities. Mind you, banks were the big holders of securities, and they had to persuade their customers it was a good idea mm-hmm. for their customers, the insurance companies, the mutual funds, etc., wealthy individuals, what have you.
Would you say that the banks were 100% behind you at this time, or were there some reservations or hesitations?
The New York banks, the major New York banks, at the top level, were behind us. They realized the stakes involved. At the working level, they didn't feel that way at all. After we were in the process of putting the transfer agent business of a New York bank out of business, over time, but out of business. Some of the custodians who were not transfer agents within the banks were seeing their empires diminish. So we were a rising sun, and their suns were setting as they saw them, as we absorbed their functions, both on the custody side of the bank and on the transfer agent side of the bank.
Did you pull in any staff from the banks? You may not remember the specifics.
Originally. I eventually hired Connie Aaron from Citibank, mm-hmm. Who was... When Walter Wriston told his staff, "You support the depository," they saluted and supported the depository. Connie was the senior vice president for securities custody, and both because Wriston favored it and because he saw the utility of this and the need for change, Connie was a supporter and a counselor to me as a Citibank employee. Until I eventually began to look for a new president, and, mm-hmm. and Connie came up on the search list and came as president in 1978, I think it was.
So at the very beginning of this period, you were chairman and CEO, but you were not president. There was another gentleman there who was president, right? Dirhan Kalustian, is that his name?
Right.
Yeah. Can you tell me about his departure?
Yes, Dirhan was the head of CCS within the Clearing Corporation of the New York Stock Exchange, and really was running this embryonic depository, which had some deposits of broker-dealer securities in the depository. When it was turned on earlier in the 70s, and the deal with me was they would hire me if I would hire Deron as the president. Well, since I knew nothing about securities custody, securities law, computers, I was only too happy to hire Deron because he was knowledgeable on this subject. That was as I began then in 72. No, 76.
I have 74, but...
74. It was only 2 years. I had learned the ropes, and I had reached the conclusion that Deron would have to go. He did some things that suggested to me that I really couldn't trust his judgment.
Okay.
So I went around to all of the directors and told them that I had decided that he should go. We had a board meeting coming up, and I would draft a letter and put it in front of him 5 minutes before the board meeting, where he resigned. And I would tell him that he could say we resigned because we had basic different philosophical judgments about business. So he resigned, and rather than be fired, 5 minutes later, and it was in the papers that we had this disagreement on management philosophy. And he left the company.
Okay.
And I became effectively president as well as... Mm-hmm. I didn't assume the title, but because I knew someday I wanted to get it. I wanted to get a president, but I thought I could handle both jobs for a while.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I'd like to ask you really quickly about the DTC's policy on fees. From a very early date, DTC basically decided to act almost as a nonprofit organization, returning any profits as such to the participants. Was this decided from the beginning?
Basically, yes. Basic's view was that the depository would earn, would make a profit, but limit its profit, and then pay dividends out to its participants, returning money to them that way. When I took over, it seemed to me, why should we pay income tax in order to pay dividends to people when we could give back the money without tax? So we adopted a policy of refunding to participants pro rata at the end of the year if we had more funds left over, pro rata based on the amount of their payments to the depository, without paying any income tax, without paying any dividends.
So DTC never paid any income tax?
No, because we didn't have any income.
Right.
Or sometimes we had to pay income. If we had to build up some cushion for a capital expenditure, we might take some income in, although we were a very good credit to anyone, obviously.
Right.
So we could borrow money at reasonable rates. But we did pay income tax on those few occasions where we didn't refund all of our excess income to our participants.
Okay. Now, at any time during your tenure at DTC, was there ever any consideration of changing that, or was it basically just set in stone?
No, once we set it in stone, participants loved the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we were not a profit-making entity. Our job was to help them make profits by reducing their expenses.
Okay.
And not to be a profit-making entity in our own right.
Mm-hmm. How concerned were you about security in the early days, for instance, about a break-in or theft of securities, fraud?
Very concerned, because this was a new idea, this whole idea of book entry and computerized certificates and reporting on computers and any fraud at all, or any theft, we feared would bring down the whole idea of a depository. So it was forefront of everything we did. Even our computer systems were proprietary, so that no one could tamper with them. At the time, we were bent over backwards. I was fond of saying we had security measures that we didn't even need in order to be a secure organization.
Did you hire outside consultants to design your security systems or evaluate them?
Yes, we did. Price Waterhouse did a lot of that for us. And if we had needed specialized services, we'd go outside and do that as well.
Mm-hmm. In your book, and I should mention here that you've written a book on the DTC that's a valuable resource for anyone who's interested in the subject. But in your book, you talk about hiring outside consultants to try to effectively penetrate the security.
Yes. Uh-huh. We would do that. We wouldn't tell anyone. I knew, the president knew, and we're the only people in the company that knew.
Was this your idea, or did it come from someone else?
I don't know. It was my idea. It was these kind of ideas are always mm-hmm. floating around in an organization like ours.
I was wondering if there's any inspiration from your days in working in national security.
I was certainly receptive to the idea. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't my idea, but it's just. It's something that any reputable organization should try to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in 1975, the Congress passed a Securities Reform Act that was pretty sweeping. Did DTC have any input into that act?
Yes, indeed. BASIC did, as a committee. It was still in existence as a committee. And involved heavily in the lobbying with both the Senate and the House committees mm-hmm. on that bill, and DTC also took a prominent role in that. I testified, the Securities Industry Association, as it was then called, the Trade Association for Broker Dealers, took the same position that BASIC and DTC took.
Mm-hmm.
There were two competing bills, well, the House bill and the Senate bill. The House bill reflected Congressman John Moss's view of things. The Senate bill was the bill that BASIC and DTC and the SIA favored. I'm not sure that the differences were fundamental in my view, but they were considered to be fundamental and the point of view of banks. Banks wanted to be sure that the Federal Reserve was involved in the regulation of the depository. And they carved out a role for the Federal Reserve in terms of the safety and soundness of any securities depository. I don't think, my recollection is not clear on this, I don't think that the House bill did that. In any case, it was the Senate bill that was supported by the industry, both banking and broker dealers, and became the legislation of the Securities Act Amendment of 1975.
Okay. Also in 1975, the DTC for the first time sold stock to other organizations than the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes, the basics formula for DTC was that the users would eventually be able to buy stock in it, and particularly they were concerned that the banks be able to have own stock in the depository as a way of giving them some influence. Broker dealers obviously would account for the great amount of activity in the depository. The banks were traders, but maybe more custodians than anything mm-hmm. else. And the banks wanted to be sure that they had a right to be at the table, not just be there at the sufferance. Mm-hmm. of somebody whose mind might change with changing characters. So banks wanted to be sure that banks had the ability, bank participants had the ability to buy stock. Once banks were able to buy their stock, and the broker dealer said, hey, why can't we buy stock? Why should the New York Stock Exchange and the NASD and the MX represent us when we could be represented directly? Now the NYSE under Jim Needham did not want that to happen.
Why not?
Because it would loosen their influence, they thought, mm-hmm. on DTC. Not that they had any to speak of, but it was a matter of pride. Also, we're majority owners of this apparently modest but successful organization. So I worked through a friend of mine at Merrill Lynch to have. Don Regan, who was the chairman and CEO of Merrill Lynch, and also a board member of the New York Stock Exchange, pressed for the ability of broker-dealers to own stock in DTC directly, and instead of being represented by the New York Stock Exchange, the NASD, and the AMEX. And Needham, of course, was happy to go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Many brokers didn't actually buy the stock because they didn't see any point in buying the stock. They were happy with the way things were, but the precedent had been set. Merrill and some others initially, as broker leaders, bought stock in the depository.
That's something I find very interesting, that the participants were concerned with the rights to be able to purchase stock, not necessarily with the purchase of the stock itself.
Because it was a financial outlay to do it.
Right.
So why do it if the organization is fine? And each year they'd have another opportunity to do it. They knew each year, if I don't buy this year, I can buy next year.
Mm-hmm. And DTC didn't need the capital.
It didn't, no.
So.
No.
Okay.
No. It was an ideal arrangement. From the only person who was concerned is me. That did it look like that people didn't, you know, why don't you have more broker dealers buying stock? Because they're happy the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
Why spend money when you don't have to?
Yeah,
and they know each year they could go back and buy the stock the next year. Because we made it clear each year we'd reallocate based on fees they pay to the depository and on other activity. That they could buy stock based on their entitlement to buy the stock each year.
Right. But was there ever any period while you were there that a number of companies bought stock? Or obviously they're buying it slowly over the years.
Some do it. I think some people thought, well, maybe it'll help me get a board seat if my company buys the stock.
But, yeah.
Or some people just felt responsible. Well, we should do it, you know, if it's a good citizen.
Right.
Good, we should do it. Okay. Most didn't.
All right. Also, during this period of the 1970s, you were continuing basics work of working with states to pass changes to the to the Universal Commercial Code.
Yes.
And when was that completed?
Well, it wasn't really completed when we spun up in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the major states had enacted the laws that we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw, if we waited to the last state, we might be waiting for a number of more years.
Right.
So all the major states were doing it. We didn't. Our lawyers felt that if any questions arose, we would prevail, and our customers, participants would prevail. So we decided we had enough states on board to go ahead.
How did that process work? Did someone just initiate contact with the relevant committee in the state legislature?
Right.
We worked with
the relevant committees of the different state legislatures and persuaded them that adopting this model uniform code amendment was the right thing to do. And other states were doing it. And when did they get with it? You know, they're going to penalize their financial institutions if they didn't do the same thing.
Was there any state that said, wait a minute, hold up, we're not sure about this?
The education process took a while.
Mm-hmm.
Took a while. Our insurance law requires the stock owned by our state chartered insurance companies to have their securities in the state, so we know we can get them if we need them. You can get them if you need them through the legal process if they're in DTC, if you have the legal authority to do all that.
Okay.
You know.
Tell me a little bit about the regional depositories that were cropping up all over the country at this time.
After BASIC was formed and its work went forward and it was clear there was going to be a depository in New York, the other major financial centers in the United States thought, hey, we have to have something too. Chicago, Philadelphia, San Francisco, and where the Pacific Stock Exchange was located. They wanted to have depositories too, because the idea was these depositories would relate to us, and we to them. They're catering to the broker dealers in their area and the banks in their area. What happened was that some of the major banks, for example, Cleveland, which was courted by the Midwest, decided they would join DTC as a participant. Because it was, in their view, in my view, much stronger as an organization. In Boston, which also was going to have a depository, and did have the New England depository, at least one of the first banks to join DTC from outside New York was State Street. Again, they saw our strength and capability and decided they would join DTC. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't they? There was no barrier to them. I was delighted, of course. I did not want to restrict DTC to just New York Bank. Mm-hmm.
But in the early days, was there a more competitive relationship then, because you were competing for the business of the different banks around the country?
It was both competitive and cooperative. Mm-hmm. We had to interface with the other depositories, because they would make deliveries, for example, from some of their participants to ours and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So the interface was important. On the other hand, we were always concerned about their financial stability. Mm-hmm. What would happen if a delivery was made from one of our participants to one of theirs and they didn't pay for it? Would the other depository pony up the money for that?
How did the deliveries work? Did you just send an armored car full of...
No. It was all book entry delivery.
Oh, by the end of
the day. You had book entry delivery, and then you relied on the settlement in their depository and the settlement in our depository.
The
payment of the money to go through one depository to the other. Mm-hmm. And it was a net situation. At the end of the day, you net down everything. Right. So we either owed money or we owed money to the other depository.
Did you all cooperate at all on changing the state laws around the country? Was that an area that you cooperated on?
We were in their states. They may have done something, but we were the Goliath of the whole thing.
Right. So there wasn't like some industry group that was going around trying to convince the state
they
legislature.
They may have.
To me, they
were irrelevant for these state law changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So in 1981, the DTC began to start holding new types of instruments, for instance, bearer bonds. What sort of new challenges did that pose?
Obviously, if someone took a security, why would you take a registered security if you could take a bearer bond security,
where
the bearer is presumed to be the owner?
Because in the bearer bond, you could just take that in exchange for cash, pretty much.
Right. Take it and sell it to a crook, because crooks very frequently use bearer bonds as their medium of exchange, which is why Congress eventually changed the law.
Uh-huh.
The decision to take bearer bonds was a difficult one in a way. Our participants badly wanted us to do that. We had made equity securities and corporate bonds eligible. Why not municipal bonds, which were all bearer bonds, almost all bearer bonds at the time? It required a new level of security. You can steal a registered certificate, even if it registered as they were, in our nominee name, CD & Co., but you have to negotiate it. And CD & Co. became a rather well-known nominee name. But bearer bonds were something quite different, so we had to build a special vault and with special procedures for monitoring that vault.
That was out on Long Island?
On Long Island. We built a big vault. To hold bearer bonds and to cautiously custody them. And then fortunately, Congress decided that because crooks were using bearer bonds very heavily and used it as a tax dodge as well, but not paying income tax on them, to require registration as of a certain date. So fortunately, going forward, we could look forward to a future of registered municipal bonds. The bad part was that sometimes the registrar was the issuer of the bonds, so who
may or may
had
not
varying,
check.
varying degrees of competence,
varying
degrees of incompetence.
Does the DTC still use that big vault on Long Island?
It's no longer there.
No longer there. Okay.
It's no longer needed.
Yeah. All right. Okay. In your book, you also talk about a dispute that you had with the New York Stock Exchange over corporations paying their interest bills on time. Can you tell me why did they need to pay the interest bills to DTC?
Well, the New York Stock Exchange had a rule that the people who were due dividends should get their money on payment date and good funds. The corporations had an interest, and payment agents often had an interest in delaying those payments. they had the float.
They could earn interest off the interest.
They could, right, exactly. They had the money and they had the float. Corporations could pay later, and the paying agents could make money off the float. And they could say, we're doing our best, you know, we mail out our dividends on the same day, you know. We mail them out in order to get to you on time. Sometimes we don't make it, but the mails are slow, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's an easy way to make money, both preserve money if you're the corporation and to make money if you're the paying agent.
Now, was this something that participants were complaining about, or did they really notice
well,
it?
No, it was our feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the stock exchange rule. Let's leverage it. If you're going to be paid on payment date in good funds, what's that mean? That means that I should be able to get cash that day. Not in the clearinghouse funds, but actual cash that day. And so we began, and it was just all generated inside DTC. Arnie Fleischig was the in charge of that unit, and he proposed that we leverage the New York Stock Exchange rule beyond the New York Stock Exchange listed companies and get everyone onto that payment on payment date in good funds. And the way to do that was to publicize we were urging people to do that and to pick out some major players who were paying late where we could know, but that we knew what their payment date was. We knew what date we received the money, and we knew what kind of what the delay was. So you could very easily paint a picture of this corporation. Mm-hmm. It's a member of the New York Stock Exchange, or listed on the New York Stock Exchange, has agreed to this rule, but it's not paying by that rule. Well, the corporation would say, "But we can't. You know, we can't. We have to treat you like everyone else." We said, "Fine. We'll come and pick up the check. And if you're willing to put." And let other people come pick up their checks.
Mm-hmm. What was the delay on the payments? Just a few days each time?
A few days.
It adds up, though.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the, as I say it in my book, one of the people who got a letter like that was the chairman of, was Raleigh Warner, the chairman of, what was this company? And a board member of the New York Stock Exchange at the mm-hmm. time. So he complained about this to John Phelan.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say in the book, Phelan began talking internally about maybe they would change the rule. I don't know that they would have.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, we began getting compliance. Mm-hmm. We began to get compliance with the rule. And I agreed to stop quoting in letters mm-hmm. the New York Stock Exchange rule. Which made Phelan happy because he wanted to be the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, and he was going around speaking mm-hmm. to meetings of the American Society of Corporate Secretaries.
And someone at the New York Stock Exchange helped to work out this arrangement.
Yes, right? Dick Russo was the go-between mm-hmm. me and Phelan to work out this modus vivendi.
All right. Next, I wanted to ask you about the big strike in 1985. But first, give me a little bit of background to that. Had the workforce at the DTC always been unionized?
Yes. When we spun out of the New York Stock Exchange in 1972 and created CCS, Inc., about 700 clerks doing clerical jobs, the custody of securities and so forth and so on, came with us, and they were all unionized. So we were, as the New York Stock Exchange was unionized, we carried that over, we had to, in the new company because the great bulk of people were union members. Of that union, and the New York Stock Exchange was a lead negotiator on our periodic contracts. We might have three contracts for 3 or 4 years. It was a multi-employer contract with the New York Stock Exchange, DTC, and SIAC, the Securities Industry Automation Corporation, mm-hmm. a part of whose workforce was also. So the Stock Exchange was the lead negotiator in all of this.
That gave them a bit of an advantage, right, because there was just one of them and then three of you, right? Or did it?
No, there were three. No. We were the junior. We and SIAC were the junior partners. Mm. The New York Stock Exchange was calling the shots,
right.
Really. And the outside counsel was a very good law firm.
That's right. You may mention that in the book, right?
They're in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Very good law firm. Mm-hmm. And I learned my labor law from participating in this this tripartite with the stock exchange and SIAC each union negotiation. And I began to see early on that the exchange was more benevolent than I would be in union negotiations. I wanted to pull out of that tripartite relationship mm-hmm. with the exchange and SIAC and negotiate my own contracts. And many people in the exchange and in my own board didn't want us to do that. Most of them had no familiarity with union negotiation. They were brokers who weren't unionized. There were banks that weren't unionized. And I just felt that the exchange was giving money away. I could see that we were paying more in benefits and in salaries than the average street worker was getting. So how do I break away? How do I get people to break? Allow me to break away and negotiate separately.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did that by making a pain in the ass of myself for John Phelan, by talking about settlement numbers that he seemed to be considering as being prodigal, and way above market, and so forth. So that when we ended one of our periodic maybe 3 or 4 years negotiations, I made a big enough pain in myself that Phelan was willing to let me go. So I just wrote him a letter saying, based on experience, I would like to negotiate the next contract, and if I don't hear from you, mm-hmm. I'll assume I have your approval. Mm-hmm. So then we faced our next negotiation. And each year, we had talked about and had done some preparation in case there was a strike. Our view was that we had to operate through a strike, through a snowstorm, through anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were nationwide in our scope, and people come to work for us, no matter what the conditions are. And so we had set up a plan to allow us to get support from broker-dealer staffs, from banks outside New York. The banks in New York didn't want to cooperate because they were all under a mandate from their management not to do anything to antagonize unions because they didn't want to be unionized themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we hired people, temps and others, to be ready in case there was a strike. And there was a strike. I don't think the International Union wanted it, but some hotheads in the depository who felt that we couldn't operate without them if they mm-hmm. went on strike turned down our offer and went on strike that night. Well, we called people in.
Over the weekend?
It was a weekend. I think it was a weekend. I'm not sure. But the next... No, it wasn't a weekend. Because the next day, we knew late that night that there was going to be a strike. It was an evening meeting. And so we alerted all the people that the strike was on, and they came in, and I kept them out for 3 weeks. The head of the union called the next day and said, "Bill, you know, we don't want to strike. The meeting got away from our guys. Mm-hmm. Let's meet and we'll solve this thing." I said, no, I'm not going to meet. You're going to pay for it." So I kept them out 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We professed to operate very well. We didn't operate quite as well as I professed we were operating.
Oh, yeah.
But we operated well.
Mm-hmm. But most of the trades were still being processed within 5 days, and most of the others. Okay.
Yeah, the computer people weren't unionized.
Mm-hmm.
It was the clerks.
Right.
The people held the certificates of the paper.
What percentage of the workforce do you think was unionized?
Well, the interesting thing was that some people came. The first day of the strike, some people crossed the picket line and came to work as union members. And that increase occurred every day.
Okay.
In the book, I think I may have some figures on that.
Yeah.
But we were, management was very encouraged about the fact that people were crossing the picket line as union members and coming to work. But I wanted to really drill home the fact that we were going to operate and could operate despite a strike. And people who didn't work for 3 weeks didn't get paid for 3 weeks. And that was the last strike DTC ever had. Mm-hmm. That was the reason we did it. And the people in DTC who came to work, both unionized and not, realized that I said, no, we have to be able to operate through a strike. Otherwise, this company doesn't deserve to exist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our whole premise is that we are there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't operate through a strike, our costs will go way up and our reputation will go way down. And that galvanized management as well. Because management, when I came to DTC, always knew that what the union workforce got in terms of salaries and benefits increases would redound to their credit as well, because they would ride on top of that.
Right.
So management didn't care, really. Many managers didn't care. Middle managers didn't care what the union settlement was, because they knew they'd always get more than that.
They're fine,
so I had to get their egos and their working on my plane.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you talk about in the book that was a very interesting story was the story of the night supervisor who you caught involved in some shady business. Why don't you tell me about that?
Yes. The one night supervisor, because we were a 24-hour-a-day operation, was paid off to misdeliver securities to certain accounts.
Who was paying him?
Of people... individuals who were finders, stock loan finders. If a company needed to borrow stock and they couldn't get stock in a legitimate way, they would arrange with a stock loan finder illegally, who would pay off a clerk to modify a delivery ticket or a delivery data to direct stock to someone who needed that stock over the weekend or overnight, or maybe for a couple, 3 days. And then it would be delivered back again. So our guy was getting paid off. The stock loan finder was getting paid off. And somebody wasn't getting a delivery to which he was entitled. This we found out after we nailed our guy that this was not uncommon on Wall Street. You have people whose job it was to be stock loan finder. I can. You need securities.
I know a guy.
Yeah. You can have a delivery of these tomorrow night if that's what you want. How many shares did you want? We'll do that.
But did this ever fall through? I mean, was there ever a case where they loaned out some stock and the deal went through and they didn't get it back?
Not as far as we know.
Okay.
I'm sure that may have happened, but not as far as we know.
Okay.
When someone caught this misdelivery, because someone's expecting stock didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who said, "Oh, why didn't you send the stock to us? We didn't.
Right.
We shouldn't get that." And they gave it back readily.
Now, how did you find this guy?
Somebody who was entitled to stock didn't get it, and someone who got it sent it back as a misdelivery.
Mm.
And somebody caught the fact that this was happening on the part of this one guy. And then that really set the in motion a very expensive process to see if anything else like this was going on, if other people were paying off our people to do something, it could be rectified later on, but was it illegal? And thievery. So I forgot the value of that delivery. It was a substantial sum. We got it all back and went into a very critical self-examination of of untoward influences on the depository by people who worked in the back offices mm-hmm. and who may cut some corners to make things happen.
Did this become public?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it might have damaged the reputation a bit.
Yeah, okay. But by the time it became public, we had corrected all of it. We'd gotten the loss back, so there was no loss.
Okay.
And
you care to comment any more on that, or should we?
No, that's
okay.
That's good.
Okay, now by that,
it was very healthy. But it was mm-hmm. a very healthy thing
mm-hmm.
because both the strike and the fact that we were penetrated. That's the wrong word, really. That someone had used us illegally
mm-hmm.
Really sensitized people to the to our responsibilities
mm-hmm.
And to be totally above board and to be wary about people who might want to do favors for them.
Right.
And that's why we promulgated tighten up
mm-hmm.
the code of conduct so that anyone who received any consideration at all, a meal, a free ticket to something,
had to report it.
Had to report it.
Right.
Had to report it, no matter
right.
what.
Seems like a fair rule. So.
Yeah.
So at the end of the 1980s, there started to be a lot of talk about the possibility of moving from a 5-day settlement to a 3-day settlement. How did DTC feel about that?
We realized it would be desirable to close, to narrow the window mm-hmm. Of unsettled trades. The question was, could the broker-dealer workforce do that?
Mm-hmm.
Was the industry able to do that?
What would have required to move from a 5-day to 3-day settlement period?
You'd have to have trades that weren't confirmed on the night of the trade date.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be confirmed for 1 or 2 or 3 days. To be confirmed sooner, you know, is getting people to confirm their activity with each other.
Mm-hmm.
If you could do a locked-in trade from the very time the trade occurred, you wouldn't have that problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the way the industry functioned, you'd have a trade, and then one broker would send his record of the trades to, let's say, the New York Stock Exchange Clearing Corporation. Another broker would do the same thing. There would be variations and all that mm-hmm. had to be ironed out. So it was always desirable to shorten the settlement cycle.
And some groups seemed pretty convinced that it was a good idea, like the G30.
Everything. It's a good idea. The question is,
mm-hmm.
if you say, we're going to do it, and it's going to work, will it work?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make a prudential judgment. Is this desirable thing possible? Can you get enough people on board so that when it happens, it doesn't blow up?
Mm-hmm.
And if you work at it long enough, you can finally get it to a 3-day settlement, which
mm-hmm.
we did, a 3-day and with it in same day funds.
Mm-hmm. But it took a number of years to get there, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, because. I think a lot of people, like such as we, felt that it's a good idea. How can we get it done in a way that works instead of a way that fails?
Mm-hmm. Now, some people discussed different ideas for speeding up the process. Some people discussed the idea of eliminating the stock certificate altogether. Was that feasible in your view?
It certainly wasn't when we were formed. Nowadays, in fact, the stock certificate has been very largely eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
When we were formed in the early 70s, the idea of abolishing the stock certificate would have been anathema to people. I mean, after all, that's how you could prove ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And
they had this debate at the beginning of the 1970s, right? Do you eliminate the stock certificate
yeah,
or not?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And by law, you couldn't eliminate mm-hmm. the stock certificate. What would you put in its place?
Right.
Well, we put book entry delivery in its place by mm-hmm. getting state law changed to permit
right.
book entry delivery to be
Because it was state law that mandated the existence of the stock certificate in the first place, right?
Right. It was also all a matter of state law.
Mm. So the federal government was relatively limited in what it could do.
Right. Okay. Couldn't touch it. And indeed, people who believe in strongly in states' rights would have fought it and paralyzed it. Would have mm-hmm. get killed politically for doing that.
Right.
No matter what party you were.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get clobbered.
Okay. In addition to this 5-day settlement period, there were some other settlement periods that were considering that they were considering being changed too, right?
No, that was the typical 5-day settlement mm-hmm. period was the key thing. Could it be changed to 3 days? Now, since we moved to a 3-day settlement period, there have been suggestions we move to a single day settlement period. In fact, the SEC has been playing around with that and may still be playing around with that idea. I think I'm not privy to any information just now on that subject, but my sense is that people realize that we're still not there yet. We're not the industry is just not there yet to move to that, and that moving from 5 to 3 may be as far as we need to go for a while. It's really substantially reduced that period of indefiniteness.
As a matter of philosophy, do you think that the DTC or its successor company, the DTCC, should err on the side of caution?
You want to? Yes, caution in the sense that you want to be sure that any change works. That any change to get the efficiency and the desirability that you wish to get doesn't fail and therefore raise questions about the whole process. And there's right now, as you know, how many billion shares are traded every day in the United States. If you think back to when it was 6 million paralyzed at the New York mm-hmm. Stock Exchange, well, you don't want anything to go wrong with that. So you want to make progress, but make progress where you know you can succeed.
Right. So in 1994, you reached the self-imposed retirement age of 65. Tell me about your search for a successor.
We had a search committee appointed from the board of directors, and they worked with me on the search. I wanted to have Bill Janicki and Tom Williams be the two top people in DTC. I know the committee thought about. The committee knew both Bill and Tom. They may have thought in their own deliberations without me being present about other possibilities, but Bill Janicki was a natural choice mm-hmm. For that job. They tootled around with the idea of making him CEO and having an industry figure be the titular chairman and kind of non-executive chairman. I shot that down, not because I thought that if you had a non-executive chairman, sort of second guessing CEO, well, first place, name me somebody you would like to have in that job. Would you do it, Tom? No. Would you do it, Dick? No. Who else? Is it just a nice idea that doesn't go anywhere? Yeah. So it didn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They could see the difficulties that would present.
Mm-hmm. So Bill Janicki was.
So Bill Janicki.
Okay. Well, Bill, looking back on your long career, do you have any final thoughts, any reflections?
I said in my farewell remarks on several occasions that the future of DTC would be would reach a dimension that no one could presently anticipate. And that's exactly what's happened. I thought that DTC would eventually absorb NSCC and its clearing corporations and become a single entity. I thought it would slowly expand internationally. I didn't know anything like derivatives were on the menu. And DTC has grown. For example, we began to do a lot of tax work on behalf of our participants, especially when there were tax treaties between the U.S. and other countries. That required us to begin to learn something about tax law and to deal with foreign taxing authority. You soon begin to build up an expertise in that no one else has, just because that was part of our job. Mm-hmm. And now that's a huge part of what DTC does for its participants. The whole idea of the trade information warehouse for derivative securities is a wonderful idea. And now to get the Europeans to buy into the idea, European regulators to buy into the idea, you duplicate the trade information warehouse in England, which is part of the European Union. The French would have liked to have it, but you know, there's a good regulatory system in the UK, and UK is part of the European Union, not of the Euro, but of the European Union. So you can satisfy European regulators by duplicating the database of the trade information depository in England. So you have no access; you have full access to all the data the DTC has. Unthinkable in 1994 when I retired, but a natural outgrowth of the kind of thing that the depository does, not its principal activity, but an ancillary activity that has assumed great importance.
Well, it's quite a story.
It is quite a story. Mm-hmm. It's quite a story. It's a story that almost, as I say in my book, that almost no one knows, because it's not clearance and settlement is not a very attractive story in itself.
As a final question, I'll ask you something. Do you think that the general public needs to know more about the way that the plumbing of the financial system works, or is it something that should just go on undisturbed?
I think they take that for granted, and that's probably all right.
Mm-hmm.
The general public needs to know a lot more things they don't know.
That's very true.
Since I don't see, as far as DTCC is concerned, I don't know that they need to know a whole lot more. How all this credit default swaps business turns out is a concern to anyone who.
Mm-hmm.
Who thinks about this subject.
I think that's something that we're all trying to still figure out. So, anyhow, Bill Dentzer, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
You're very welcome, Dave.